AWL Butters. We are in Victoria and the date is August 19th. Alright, maybe we could begin with where and when you were born.
I was born in Epsom, England at the Canadian Convalescent Hospital in 1918. My father was the one of the principal doctors at that hospital. I was born in January of 1918.
And did your family have a military background?
Yes, on my mother's side particularly. The military history goes back in a sort of a continuous succession back into time, going back to the War of 1812, for heaven's sake, when one of the Richardsons, her name was Richardson, was commander of a frigate on the Great Lakes, which was apparently, he lost his leg in that engagement anyway. That, and there's a continuous history from there, even through the Rial Rebellion and not the War of South Africa, however, we didn't have any representation there, okay.
And First World War?
First World War, my father, of course, as I say, was in Epsom. mother's brother was won the Military Cross, was promoted and commissioned in the field with the artillery, and there were others. I can't quite think of them at the moment, okay.
Okay. When did you become involved in the military?
I became involved, first of all, in the Canadian Officers Training Center at UBC in 1937, I think it was, and subsequently left university because I couldn't continue due to reasons, mostly financial, okay, and I became re-involved in Courtenay, British Columbia, where I was working at that time. And in August of 1939, when things started to heat up, and I joined the Canadian Scottish Sea Company in Courtenay as a private, okay?
Okay, let's talk about conditions as a private and what life was like for you.
Well, it was, having worked in logging camps and for extensively during my time at university, it was a great experience. It really, we came to Victoria as a unit in, I believe it was the winter of 1939-40. I lived in Work Point Barracks as a unit. We went to DeBert, Nova Scotia, which was a most traumatic experience. We were the first regiment actually into DeBert, Nova Scotia. In the winter of, that would be the winter of 40-41, we lost a third of our regiment, or our battalion, to illness, mostly because some of them were a little older than they perhaps should have been.
While you were at DeBert?
While we were at DeBert, yes, sir. Raging measles and scarlet fever, whooping cough, all the diseases came boiling to the top. It was really quite a bad experience. However, we got through that.
What was the accommodation like then? Were you constantly cold? I've heard that it was really bad winter.
Well, it was cold, yes. It was a cold time. But I think the thing that bothered me more than anything was the soft coal, which was burnt in the H huts. A stove, I think, three stoves in each wing or something. I've just forgotten. But the smoke in the morning was from the coal burning and the wind blowing and so on. Was quite intense, and if you were in an upper bunk, which I was, it was quite choky. Yeah, it was quite an experience. I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world. Okay.
What was the training like there?
Cold, and we did ski training. You may have heard from others that we did a little of that, and digging of. We did some trenching. I remember that. A lot of drilling when we were able to, but there were no parade grounds to begin with. It didn't really amount to much. It was mostly a matter of survival, I think.
But had the equipment started to come in compared to 1939 when you joined?
I was kilted, fortunately, because I had gotten in early enough to have a uniform. The battle, I've forgotten when the battle dresses came in. Must have been sometime around then. I don't remember, whatever time it was. I do remember being very cold on guard duty at Dobrychuk, and you probably heard that from others as well. Yeah, go ahead.
What were, you were a private at this time?
Private, acting lance corporal without pay, lance corporal with pay, substantive.
How much was it?
Corporal, I made corporal too, and lance sergeant when I went overseas, and go ahead, I would come to that later on.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about during this period?
No, it was a very good time. The men who were with us were all Up Island fellows from Cumberland and Courtney, and although I wasn't literally from that country, I had lived there when I was very young, but I'd come there from Vancouver to work, in, as I say, before I joined up. So this was a matter of getting to know a lot of people I did not know. And I think we did very well. I think I hung on very well. I was totally out of my league, but I soon became accepted by everyone.
Did they have had a lot more training?
No, because they all knew one another, you know. I was an outsider, but it worked in beautifully.
And what was the day you went overseas?
Oh, my goodness gracious me. I believe it was August of 1941, whenever the 3rd Division went anyway, 7th Brigade.
How was your crossing?
Well, it was made somewhat easier because I was in charge of one of the large sort of places that we were in hammocks, as I remember it, and it was pretty grim going out. I can't remember. I made 4 crossings, and I have trouble with keeping them sorted out. Okay. But it seems to me that it was a tough time, with a lot of illness and not having fresh air and so on. Okay.
Crowded conditions.
Crowded, and yeah.
Okay. What was your first impression of England?
Little story. Okay.
Okay.
Into up the Clyde to Glasgow, I guess. Onto a little train, which was so small, and the cars were so small, no one had ever expected that. And a lot of fellows with excellent senses of humor, and the train was getting ready to go, and it made that funny little toot that the English trains make, which was kind of a boop boop, and someone down in the car yelled out, "Oh, another peanut roasted," you know. I thought that was, I remember that very well. It was an impression of smallness, yes. Okay.
And you went up to Aldershot?
We went to Aldershot, yeah.
How were conditions there?
Well, I guess you've heard this so often, that it was clean, and it was old, and it was magnificently preserved in the circumstances. And the floors were very hard, and the palliasses were insubstantial, and that's fine. It was okay. That was part of the deal. No, we were moved out of there to the defense of southern England, and we moved around the coast from Seaford to various places. And I was made lance sergeant at that time. I guess it was, yeah.
While you were defending the coast?
Yep.
Did you ever think that invasion was likely?
Yes. I don't think the military situation, I know more about it now than I did at that time. We were just doing a job and making the best out of what we could, okay? Did a lot of training of home guard people, did some of that. The Canadians were doing this kind of thing, and as an NCO, I did that. I did a course with Lieutenant Rockingham, now Major General, and he and I ran a course. He was the lieutenant, I was the sergeant for a bomb disposal squad from London who were actually working with bombs, and they were taken out to go down and learn battle drill, for God's sake, you know, kind of a crazy thing, but that was great. It was a nice little break, yeah, for them and for us.
And from there, where did you go?
I was, just stop your tape for a moment. Give me your question again.
Okay, where did you go after?
Well, we did, there was a lot of this training went on, and then it went on in the summertime, and in August of 1942, I was, it was July of 1942. I was sent back to, I'd already been through the boards for commission and so on in London, and we were the second class to be sent back to Canada for our commission. We did not go to whatever the name of the place is in England now. The name escapes me. In any case, we were sent all the way back from England to Gordon Head, myself and one other from the Canadian Scottish, Ian MacDonald. And started our class in August of 1942. Did very well, actually. There were three of us from overseas, Ian MacDonald, myself, and one other. And we were ranked first, second, and third in the large class of 60-odd, and kept on as instructors at Gordon Head. A friend of mine came back from England to do a subsequent course while I was on instructional staff at Gordon Head, Bob Turnbull, and Bob was also given an opportunity to instruct at Gordon Head if he wanted to, because we were on a 3-month term. But Bob had a wife in England, and I had just been married here to my wife Jackie, who you met in January of 1943. Bob went back. I traded places with him and had a 6-month tour of duty at Gordon Head, and he went back to his wife in England. Okay.
What sort of training were you doing? Was it commando training for the people coming into the school?
No, we were doing officers' training center. We did not much of that. That was done in Calgary in the advanced officers' training, and I did some work there too later on. But no, we were into weapons. My particular subject was weapons and a bit of tactics and general stuff like that. It was quite good.
So how long altogether did you spend? Was it 6 months or 9 months?
Six months I spent at Gordon as an instructor. 9 months all total.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you went back overseas?
No, I went to Calgary for a month. My wife by this time was pregnant, and I was given the option while I was in Calgary, which I didn't tell my wife about, she knows now, but didn't know at that time, by a Major Oliver to come out to Pacific Command as a staff person. I don't know quite what capacity, I don't think that was ever defined, or return to my unit in England, and I opted to go back to England and return to the Canadian Scottish. So that, in the meantime, that goes on from there, okay?
Okay.
Well, by this time, the unit was the beginnings of the exercises for the pre-D-Day stuff, and it was a smarter, more up-to-date unit than the one I had left. I was glad to have a platoon, glad to be back. I think I fit in quite well, because there were certain binds to a person being promoted from the ranks to and come back to command in that same unit, and the same people were there. There weren't any, I had no problems at all, but it was, at times it was awkward and difficult, and your sympathies get divided, and it's a strange situation. Okay?
Okay, let's talk about some of the training and preparation for the D-Day invasion.
Oh my goodness me. Goodness me. There was a lot of it, okay? A lot of it. a tremendous amount of route marching, tremendous amount of conditioning, physical conditioning and mental conditioning, I suppose, too. Isle of Wight, the winter of before D-Day, we actually landed, I don't know if you've had anyone interviewed on this subject before, we landed with bicycles, assault bicycles, and we were trained on assault bicycles on the Isle of Wight during the winter, which included landing from assault craft and up to your neck in water, and then riding your bike home in the freezing weather at 16 or 18 miles. Thought nothing of it. It was great stuff, you know. You did it because everybody else did it, and it was a part of the thing. You couldn't question too much, and I don't think we did question that much. We were there to do a job, and if it this is how it had to be done, and that was it.
How well do you think the training helped the actual invasion?
Oh, immensely, immensely, immensely. It soon became evident that, of course, by this time I'm a platoon commander, and if there, I think something that happened, which I think was very important, was that those of us who stayed on and lasted through the training and the selection process that was going on, when it came toward the end of the getting closer to D-Day, say within 3 or 4 months of June, if we didn't like a person in our platoon, we didn't have to give a reason. We didn't have to. We simply said we were like that man replaced, and we got somebody else. And you were selecting, and the number of troublemakers or people that didn't fit into that particular category of person you as an individual were looking for, you could very easily have him transferred to something else and have somebody else come in. Okay, and a lot of that went on. I did quite a bit of that.
Okay, you talk about the time right before the invasion,
the
concentration area.
Oh yes, at Winchester. Yeah. The most terrifying part of that was hearing the flak come down from the anti-aircraft and sleeping in tents, and nothing ever happened, but I remember being a little uncomfortable about that. Oh yeah, that was a long spell of being isolated from everything, and
couldn't leave
your barbed wired in and the whole thing, except under very strict circumstances, and I've forgotten how long that went on. You probably know.
I think it was a couple of months.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Seemed to be that anyway. Well, there was an awful lot of time spent sort of looking at maps, and then, actually we weren't briefed, and we had maps, but they were code marked, I remember. One of them was called the River Ottawa, and there were various local names given to the little stretch of beach that we were landing on. I think we had, 1,000-yard map or something, so that you couldn't identify where it was exactly, but... Yeah, I can't remember too much about that, to be quite frank. It was, there was no anticipation, there was no worry. It was just a matter of putting in time, which we were pretty good at by that time. Mm-hmm. Right, okay.
Okay, let's talk about the actual invasion. It took me through from the time you woke up until the end of the day, the highlights in that period.
Yeah, there was quite a highlight. We played a lot of poker here, remember? Called Liar's Poker or something. No, Liar's Dice. No, I've forgotten. In any case, it was a good time. We had an enormous breakfast, I remember, on the transport ship, which we landed in the small assault craft, okay, and there were a number of them on that we got into just before it was a few miles offshore. In any case, the night before was, dark. There was, again, no sense of danger, though. There was, at least I don't recall it, having been concerned about anything. Everything was going to be all right, kind of. And the long run in with the assault craft, everyone was quite sick. As we came in closer, the one of the craft next to us got hit, and then we began to realize what was happening. First thing we ran into, of course, was this thing called Element C, which you probably know about. These really triangular angle iron stands in the water with the rear, at the back of them they had a nest mine sitting ready to blow, and we actually were heading right for one and got shifted off by a wave. It was rough as hell, and went in. We landed, alongside of us landed at almost the same moment another platoon headed by a fellow by the name of Gordy Radcliffe. And Gordy got killed going down the ramp, and I saw that happen, and then I realized that something was really going on, and it was a hell of a long haul from where we touched down to the dunes up ahead. It was scary then. It was quite scary. And we all got up the beach. And into the dunes, down, get your head down, and there was machine gun working from the left flank, I remember, in a farmhouse over the dunes and in the fields and behind, which were partly underwater. And I guess we were all frozen for a moment. And this is when Philip, whose name may have come up before, I hope it has. I have a picture of him around here. Jack Bryden, who was a Victoria person, Captain Bryden, was second in command of the company. Tommy McEwen from Duncan was the company commander. Jackie was second in command. And he came up to where we were, because he was at the tail end where two ICs operate. And they said, okay, let's go. And he walked out across this minefield with the machine gun spatting from the left. And we all followed exactly where Jack put his feet down, of course. And we got across the field. And I think we lost some men doing it, but I don't think there were that many. It was quite a good deal. And that's how we got ashore. We were on the beach and we were in the dunes and we'd gotten across the dunes and we moved inland then. And actually, what I'm going to say sounds so horrendously egotistical, but it happened, okay? D Company, which was the company I was with, was and the move inland was at the head of the battalion, okay? And 18 Platoon, which I commanded, was at the head of D Company. So we were actually at the point of the invasion of Europe at that time. And we got 8 miles inland. I remember this well. And there was an order came forward to stop. And then we turned around and came back 3 miles to dip for the night, to put into going to the defensive fortifications for that night. But for that particular time, we were miles out ahead of anyone, okay? Too far ahead, actually, as it turned out. I know that now. I didn't know it at the time, okay? So the following night, we went forward. The following day, the day following that, which I think would be around the 8th now, 8th or the 9th, I really always forget which day, the Winnipeg Rifles were manning the forward company, the forward position, okay, on the right. Regina Rifles were on the left, and we were in reserve. Those are the three battalions in the brigade. And the 12th SS Panzer Division counterattacked John Meldrum's Winnipeg Rifles. They attacked, actually. And there was a tremendous battle went on all day. We could hear this because we were in reserve. And at 7 o'clock that night, the Winnipegs were, we could see them coming back. We could see them hobbling back and they were shot up, they were scared, there was all hell breaking loose. 7 o'clock that night time, at that night, the company commander was sent for and we were ordered into the attack. And it was so rapid, that if you haven't heard this before, good, if you have heard it before, I'll confirm it. It was so rapid that the company commander had to brief his platoon commanders about what we were doing while we were on the move to the start line. Okay, that's how fast it happened. The plan was to attack across open fields using a road we were on the right, I think C Company was on the left, and so on and so forth. And the other two companies were in reserve. And we were therefore forward and right, and there was nothing to our right at all. Okay, we were very much on our own. We went forward and we ran into my platoon particularly, and the company as a whole ran into a very devastating crossfire, a real machine gun fire, and there was not one but two or three. As a matter of fact, I shot one guy out of a tree who was firing a machine gun from up there, and I lost. I guess out of my 37 men, I lost all told about 30, okay, because there were only a handful of us got to the far end. Art Plows was one of the people who sort of gathered that thing together. Art couldn't remember the story better than I do. I was frankly very, very frightened, got myself together, got forward, got up onto the railway track, which was our objective, and we dug in there. And I'd like to stop just for a moment there. We were counterattacked ourselves, a very light counter, sort of a mobile skirmish during the night. However, the next morning, German tanks appeared, and I think they were Panther tanks, but I'm not sure. Okay, in any case, they were hull down, out of range of our six-pounders, which were the only anti-tank weapons we had at that time, and they plastered us from their hull down positions away across the fields. We brought artillery down on them, but that didn't help at all, and moved infantry up through the bush. We were able to fire at that and stop the infantry from getting across. We were actually on the home side of a railway cutting, the Khan Bayou Railroad, just beside the bridge there, and that in itself was helping us to sort of stave off. It was a clear demarcation line, and it was a defensive position. And during that day, we figured that they came at us about 10 times, and we were able to hold on each time, and I think mostly due to our plows as organizational abilities and those of us who were left, and we had weapons. We used the Germans' weapons against them, turned them around and fired them against them until we got an order from Cable Dew, who was the officer commanding, not to do that because it was confusing the intelligence people at the back. They didn't know what was going on. So we continued to use their weapons because they were good. And we were successful in holding on to the place. And that evening, they pulled us back a mile because we were the only company up there, what was left of us. And they pulled us back to a battalion position about half mile, three quarters of a mile to on the safe side of the railway track. And we stayed there for quite a long time. I remember that. We were there for a few days, and we were able to collect ourselves and get shaved and so on and so forth. I had vowed that I was not going to shave until we were relieved by the 51st British Highland Division, which was the plan. And of course, the 51st British Highland Division never came, so Larry Henderson, who was my company commander, said, "Well, you're after about 3 or 4 days of not shaving, you'll have to get rid of that." And I did. Okay. Where do we go from here? Better shut it off for a second there. So we stayed in this place, which was called Puto en Besson, pretty well, for 2 or 3 days, as I remember it. And then we moved, and a night move, to the flank, the left flank, to a place called Rots, R-O-T-S. When we were there, this was a part of the realignment and figuring out. Now we knew where Khan was, and we knew what the fields looked like out in front of Khan, and a lot of patrol work was done from there. I took one patrol out. I remember we were out all night, and we got close enough that we were literally lying in the ditch while a German patrol went by on the road above us, and that was scary. I didn't like that at all. We did sort of kept our presence known for a number of weeks actually that went on, until they mounted the attack on Khan itself. Which was really a staged thing. It was right out of WW1, I thought, but we moved up for that again. Let's see, Pa, turn off for a second. By this time, I'd been moved from a platoon commander at D Company, and I was second in command of Charlie Company. And Des Crofton, I think, was the CO, but I forgot. Adiova was the company commander, not the battalion commander. In any case, we moved down through a place called Outhi, another place called Gouchy and Bouron, which were the towns that were the keys to the attack on Khan, and we were interview them and go move in. And, oh my goodness me, I can't figure the chronology out of what I'm going to tell you now, but right in that time frame, within a day or so of that time, another fellow who I can't remember who it was and myself went down into Caen because the Germans had left, apparently. We had heard that they had left. And we did a little walk down there one evening kind of thing after all this immense fighting. How on earth we ever did it, I'll never know. And we got into the eastern outskirts of Caen, there's a road that runs out, and I don't think this has ever been written about, nor have I ever found any reference except in one place, but we were met by a Frenchman who was out getting some vegetables in his garden because it was beginning, it was dark and quiet, and they were all, the civilians were terrified of what was going on, and they were all holed up in various places, and he took us. He was speaking to us in French, and we were able to understand just to, for us to please come with him. We went to a place where there was a pit, a mine shaft that went straight down in the earth. For quite a long, there was a ladder, with a steel ladder that went down on the wall of this thing. It was a mine shaft straight down, and there was light at the bottom of it. And at the bottom, we could see people, women and children, walking back and forth across the opening there. This was one of the mines, some kind of a mine that they do there. And he was getting the vegetables from the vegetable garden to take down to this group of people who were literally living at the bottom of this mine, okay? And it was quite a revealing, sort of a moving sensation. We were able to leave him something, cigarettes or something, I think, and then we went back to where we, whence we had come. And we came through Caen. Okay, the next fighting part of this thing is that the enemy in the meantime had occupied a place called Fossel, which is the other side of the Orne River. Caen is, has the Orne River running down through the middle of it. We were on the near side, the Germans were on Fossel on the other side, and then down the middle of it, like at Granville Island in Vancouver, there was an island, okay, and it was an industrial island. I spent quite a long time, a better part of a week on that island with my platoon, I must have been platoon commander still then. I must have been. I can't remember this part, okay? In any case, we spent a whole week or so down there, and every time you moved, there were Germans, snipers that were zeroed in on us, and it was a pretty tense time, because they were sneaking people across us, and we were sneaking people back over again, and it was really quite a forward position, and it was bump, bump,